Hello, and welcome to The Real, the podcast where culture and entertainment meet. I'm your host, Mark Olson. On today's episode, filmmakers Josh and Benny Safdie, directors and co-writers of the new film Uncut Gems.
I'd spent so much time in research in the Diamond District, and you would do a project, and out of curiosity, you would just, maybe you'd be in the neighborhood, I'm going to take a left through 47th Street, and you take that one walk, and it's infectious. It's a very unique place on the planet in that it's very old world. It's handshake deals. It's cash-based. Cash will be illegal within the next couple of years. And there are these things that that exist amongst the industry there, these physical, mythic, little, shiny objects. They're objects. That's all they are. But they have a mysticism towards them.
That's coming up later. But first, I'm here with my colleague, Amy Kaufman, to talk about this week's culture news. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
So there's been a lot going on this week with Harvey Weinstein back in the headlines again. Can you kind of summarize what's been going on for our listeners?
So up to now, we've sort of in the past year, have only seen Harvey Weinstein in these shots walking to and from the courthouse. And increasingly, he's looked sort of more and more frail. He has like a walker or a cane. And this week he got a back surgery, and the New York Post did this exclusive interview with him from his hospital room. He said he did the interview so that people would know that he wasn't faking his injuries, that they were legitimate. And along with the interview were these pictures, these close-up pictures of the tubes draining his wounds and, you know, him in the room just, I guess, sort of legitimizing that he really is injured. However, he also, of course, was asked by the journalist about his feelings about his upcoming court trial and how he feels about all the accusations that have been lobbed against him. And he sort of took the opportunity to present himself as a victim. He said he feels like the forgotten man. He feels like people aren't focusing on all the good he did for women in Hollywood over his many decades working at the Weinstein Company. And he wishes that would be focused on more than these allegations.
And how are people responding to this interview?
Not well. You know, it's coming just weeks before he has this trial where he is going up against women who are charging him with rape. And ever since it happened, 23 women who call themselves the Silence Breakers released a statement saying they felt like Harvey was sort of gaslighting society and they don't feel they haven't forgotten anything he's done to them.
And who are some of the people that signed this letter?
It's a lot of the women who spoke out early in the first New York Times and New Yorker investigations. Rosanna Arquette, Ashley Judd, Rose McGowan. And, you know, they were pretty forceful in the letter. Here's part of what they wrote. He says in a new interview he doesn't want to be forgotten. Well, he won't be. He will be remembered as a sexual predator and an unrepentant abuser who took everything and deserves nothing. He will be remembered by the collective will of countless women who stood up and said enough. We refuse to let this predator rewrite his legacy of abuse.
And in the interview, he specifically said something about Gwyneth Paltrow?
Yeah, I mean, he sort of singled her out and sort of said that she had made $10 million for this movie in 2003, and he was singling her out by way of saying, like, I helped this actress raise her quote pretty much in an independent film and make her a big movie star. Like, look what I have done for one of the biggest female names in the industry. I mean, it's like he's not, I don't understand why it's like, I couldn't have done anything bad because I once did maybe something good is sort of his logic, I guess.
Why now? Why do you think Harvey Weinstein decided to do this interview now just before he begins this new trial?
I mean, again, he sort of doubled down on the idea that it was about his medical issues, which was weird to me. I mean, I don't know at this point who was advising him. Like, he's had so many lawyers, so many crisis PR people who he sort of has for a few months, and it seems like there's another one on the docket. So I don't know who's advising him at this point or if he's just sort of taken the reins and is doing what he wants. But it definitely sets the tone that during this trial, it doesn't seem like we're going to have Harvey Weinstein who's had like a change of heart or is taking a different tack. It seems like he's going to be fighting the whole way.
And there was also a settlement reached on at least one of the lawsuits against him, but people are sort of upset even about that.
Yeah, so there's this tentative deal Weinstein reached with his accusers in which there will be $25 million settlement agreement with dozens of the women who allege sexual misconduct. But in this deal, he's not required to admit any wrongdoing or pay anything to the accusers himself. I think, you know, some of the women who will be receiving the payouts or were alleged victims of Harvey feel like this is barely scratching the surface of all of the damage he's done. But at the same time, if some of the money can help some of these women with their therapy bills, with the work they lost as a result of this, anything that can go towards their peace of mind, then it's better than nothing. But it's not the outcome I think a lot of people were seeking.
His whole case is something I think we're going to continue to keep an eye on. Obviously, his saga has been very pivotal as we've been sort of moving forward in kind of the Me Too era. And that's something we'll just probably be talking about again in the future.
Definitely. I'm going to be watching the proceedings very carefully. So we'll be checking in soon.
Thanks for being here. And now, it's time for Glenn Whip's Awards Minute.
So there's a little movie out right now. It's called Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. You may have heard of it. And it stars, among others, the great actor Adam Driver, who is also in another movie that's been streaming for a couple of weeks now on Netflix, Marriage Story. And Adam Driver is very much in the conversation for Best Actor this Oscar season. I can't imagine a world in which Adam Driver does not earn a nomination for Marriage Story. How might Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker affect Adam Driver's Oscar prospects? In the movie, no spoilers, you don't have to put the earmuffs on right now, there is a 5-minute sequence which is as good as anything Adam Driver has ever done, and Adam Driver has done a great many awesome things as an actor. And a lot of people are going to see this movie. I don't think everyone's going to love this movie, but you're definitely going to come away with even more respect for Adam Driver than you had going in. Adam Driver's also been in the news this week for walking out of a Terry Gross interview on NPR because he did not want to listen to himself in a clip that she was going to play. And that's such an Adam Driver thing. He is an odd, very actor with a capital A actor kind of guy. And so is Joaquin Phoenix, who's also in the conversation for lead actor this year. And it'll be interesting to see how voters respond to these two very committed actors who kind of operate on their own frequency. So there you go, folks. An Oscar Awards Minute.
Thank you, Glenn. And I'm here today with filmmakers Josh and Benny Safdie, directors and co-writers of the new film Uncut Gems. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Yeah. Co-writers along with Ronald Bronstein.
Yeah.
What is kind of the most succinct description of the movie? Like what for you guys is like the elevator pitch version
of
the movie?
We've had this discussion.
Hold on. Actually, I just wrote one down the other day and everyone told me, and then Ronnie was like, that's weird. I don't know if I like it that much, but I'm going to read it out loud just for you guys. Gems is about a New York City jeweler named Howard Ratner who owes a bunch of money to a lot of people. He's in a tough place, but with the help of those who believe with him and a large uncut gem from Ethiopia, he's going to show them all that he's all right.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, know, there's a basketball player involved.
Ronnie was like, that's a little strange. Yeah. It's a little new agey, but I'm down with it.
You guys can tell me how you feel about it, but to me, Uncut Gems feels like such a summation of the work that you've been doing up to now. I mean, it's sort of interest in kind of street life. There's something about addiction and self-destructive behavior. There's basketball. Yeah. Does it feel that way to the two of you?
Very much so. You know, it seems like the movies that we were making before gave us the ability to make this movie in the way that it should have been. You know, we thought we could have made it earlier. You know, it's something we wanted to make, a movie of this world. But we didn't have the skill set necessarily to make it properly.
Naturally, Uncut Gems was our meta destination. That was our North Star since Daddy Long Legs. And it was supposed to be the follow-up to that movie 10 years ago. And so it's only natural that the stuff that we've made in the interim, the documentary basketball player named Lenny Cook, heaven knows what, the lead actress we met doing research in the Diamond District, she was temporarily working there, which turned into her story. Rob Pattinson saw that movie. He wanted to work on whatever we're working on next. He wasn't quite right for Gems. We started talking. I was reading Executioner's song. That turned into Good Time, which was in a weird way a place for us to try to work out and flex a genre and pacing muscle, which we needed to learn. And all those roads basically led to Uncut Gems.
It was just, oh, we want to make this next. It's like, sorry, you can't. It's like, okay, what do we do? You can't. And it's like, all right, well, what else is there out there? And you kind of search for what is pulling you, you know? And then it was like, oh, Lenny Cook, there's this basketball documentary. Oh, we can do that really quickly was our original thought. 6 months, but then it was a 4-year project, you know, that was stretched all the way through other projects that we were making. So there, it was just kind of following these things that, like Josh was saying earlier, that you don't necessarily understand why it's pulling you in those directions, but it is, and you're learning from them.
The interests of our past work are included in the journey of Uncut Gems. Like, again, like Uncut, Heaven Knows What, was the great investigation into dark romance and following a dark romance, maybe against your better, you know, judgment. Good Time is about a compulsion in believing in a dream
and
trying to get there under any circumstance possible. And Lenny Cook was the inspection of a fallen Greek god, you know, and the inspection of basketball as a sport in a weird way and what it takes to be that person. So for you to have that reaction is only natural. And I do think that what's tough for us right now is we have a lot of ideas of things we want to do right now and projects that we're very interested in, but it's almost like we did this, you know what I mean? This is what it was about. And what happens when you've gotten, what do? You turn around and go back home, or do you keep going, or do you try to find a whole other vibe destination?
You start riding a bicycle instead of driving a car.
So it's tricky.
What do you feel was the thing that pulled you through all those years and kept driving you? Okay, in particular, the Diamond District feels like such a great location for the two of you in particular to be making a movie.
Yeah.
And was it just the energy of that street?
The energy, the vibe, it's like it only can exist in New York City, that specific version of it. You know, there's other diamond places, but the district itself has its own vibe. And yeah, it's populated with people who we love, you know, that kind of character.
I mean, it's funny you mention, is it the energy that keeps you coming back to it? The like stark reality was that's the exact answer. I'd spent so much time in research in the Diamond District, and you would do a project, and out of curiosity, you would just, maybe you'd be in the neighborhood, I'm going to take a left through 47th Street, and you take that one walk, and it's infectious. It's a very unique place on the planet in that it's very old world. It's handshake deals. It's cash-based. Cash will be illegal within the next couple years. And there are these things that that exist amongst the industry there, these physical, mythic, little, shiny objects. They're objects. That's all they are. But they have a mysticism towards them. And they feel like things that you could transcend your place and what have you. Since we were kids, our dad worked in the Diamond District for a pretty wild character, also named Howard. It's not based on him in any way, but it was inspired by that world. Like you're saying, it was like, wow, there's this world here, totally unique. Also, you can't take a cell phone picture on 47th Street without getting punched in the face. And here we were after 6, 7, 8 years of research embedded in the Diamond District. Not only are they letting us take cell phone pictures,
we have access to a whole like jewelry exchange and every booth we have access
filming,
to.
Filming, allowing us to do film tests in 2015 on film and audio recordings of weird business deals and getting deep involved with the Bukharian community there and helping design an Uzbeki lounge on the top of one of these buildings. It felt like, wow, it's very hard to gain access. And it was hard to gain access. We, at the beginning, you know, there was very few jewelers on the block who even gave us the time of the day. The guy who our dad worked for was a long time out of the business, so it wasn't like that connection would help. And yeah, so we had to constantly foray and parlay press clippings with some of these jewelers to be like, hey, look, check this out. Like, we actually are doing real shit here. Look at this press clipping. And then Lenny Cook actually did break down some barriers for them because it went on to blew up on World Star and it reached them. And then they're like, oh, wait, that guy who comes in all the time tells us he's making a movie. He actually has made some stuff that's on like to them, the idea of something being on television, like something being on Showtime was like big and huge. So it was tough. So when you put that much sweat into it, you kind of become a compulsive character like Howard. You know, like where the movie ends and we start is kind of, it's interesting because there is a kind of strange reflection of the journey of making the movie.
I'm so interested in how you guys work in that it's partly that you're sort of conventional screenwriting, but some of it is also sort of bleeds into casting in the way that you meet people and you sort of write roles towards people. What is that process like?
It's no surprise that after we made Daddy Long Legs with Ronnie, we developed kind of a deep collaboration with him there on that movie. And then that's, we brought the first draft to him there. and from there kind of took on a whole life of its own. When you talk about casting, there is this element of you can write it on the paper, but once you cast somebody, it has to take on a whole different light. You know, it has to be then tailored to them particularly, and then we'll find new characters who then in turn will determine what is going to be on the page. Oh, they won't do this. This is how they talk. And, you know, you kind of try and do that. And for a long time, it was actually hard because Howard wasn't Howard yet. You know, there wasn't, we always wanted Adam Sandler, but we couldn't get him right away. And then, so it was a matter of like, once we finally got Adam, you know, to do it, and we were talking together, that's when it became also even took another step in a totally different.
I think the writing processes on this one was obviously interesting just from the longevity of it. And it's not like other, like long, like someone asked a Q&A, is like, so you wrote this 10 years ago? It's like, no, we started writing it 10 years ago. It's not like we're just going to like become sentient filmmakers where we're going to sit around and let the river run its course. You know, we're going to constantly adapt things. And again, we're learning from the projects that we've done. How did we push this emotion? Can we get to a new feeling? Can we mess with narrative in an interesting way? How do we mess with narrative? So what was crazy about this project was about every, I'd say like 9 months or 8 to 9 months, we would go back and not do a page one rewrite, but not very far. And then it got to a place around 2015 where the general structure of the movie was kind of reached. The last 20 minutes in particular were really solid. I think there's over 123 drafts of this of the movie. And a lot of that goes into, again, yeah, what Benny was saying was the casting process, but it's also the constant reworking. Okay, with good, like Benny's character in Good Time was a character in Uncut Gems at one point. So
but then you
make that movie and then you take it out.
Okay, so this character's developed. You know, we talk about it. This is who it's going to be. I'm going to play that part. But then it was going to be in Gems. But then Gems isn't happening anymore. What do we do with this character? We really like him. He's very special. And we want to kind of do something with him. And then he gets put into Good Time. You know, and then there's a version of him now who exists in Good Time. And then it's like what Josh was saying. All these movies happen. You then express things in those films that don't necessarily then need to be a part of what was Gems.
Kevin Garnett, it's such a phenomenal performance.
Yeah.
And yeah. You know, the way that the story weaves itself around the actual events of an NBA playoff series from 2012 is incredible. And then he's acting in the movie against, you know, moments from real life from, a number of years ago. I mean, how did you guys keep all that just straight in your heads? I mean, that's complicated stuff.
Well, yeah, it was actually, that was very fun and interesting because having the constraints of that real game were very important.
Real games.
You know, the real games. Yeah. That, okay, now that this is the timeline it has to take place in, it kind of sets this rigid structure that you can't stray from. And it actually dictates a lot of what the characters have to do. And it's very fun. We always love fiction and reality. So this, having this real center with these games kind of changes your perception of everything around it.
It frames it in a kind of interesting way. Because we do like to work with a lot of people it's their first time doing a movie. Some of the people we work with never even think about being in a movie. And next thing you know it, they're acting opposite Adam Sandler. You know, there's a lot of professionals and a lot of veterans in it, which was awesome. And a lot of it was just trying to create this kind of democratic playing field where everybody's the same. And Kevin, in particular, you have an instinct when you meet people. Can they perform? Can they perform being themselves? What does that mean? And he very much had a career in the NBA as playing himself. He was a heel. He knew that he was a heel. First thing I said to him when I met him is, I hate your guts. And he was like, what do you mean you hate me? And he was laughing about it. And I was like, because I'm a Knicks fan and I hate you. And you do an incredible job making people hate you. That's playing yourself. That's wrestling. That's WWF. So like he knows he had a sense of timing. And then when he started to tell stories to us, you know, he told three or four incredibly detailed, quite long narratives from Chicago.
So many characters, and he sets up the positioning. All of a sudden, you feel like you're in a virtual reality because you have a full vision of everything that he's talking about. People, where they're sitting, and then you can kind of visualize it all. And then
he's reading the room to see if you're following, and if you're not, he'll give you a side comment. So he's just
he's keeping you in, and he's kind of pulling in, and that's acting, you know, reading the room and changing your performance based on what's happening around you.
Yeah, so when we sense that narrative storytelling gift, and you know his history in the NBA, and you're actually feeling his persona in real life and the passion that he exudes, you just know, okay, he's going to be great. You just know it. And then you get on set and he has a 5.5-page scene and you start to wonder, is this the right method? Do we want to get rid of the dialogue and try to work and build it organically? And then he wants to work with the dialogue. So then, and then he referred to it. He called me coach. And I was like, what do you mean coach? He goes, you're the coach. This is the playbook, pointing to the script. Personally, I was ready to be done working ever after once I heard that, because that was just incredible. It was fun to write for who the quote unquote Kevin Garnett is. And it was even more interesting to see him interpret that and work
and
with
then,
it.
Yeah, to see his ability to kind of understand the perception and then act that out. Because he always says, like, oh, I was just being myself. You know, that's not easy to be able to play a version of what you believe you are comfortably and believably is a very difficult thing to do, because you have to just kind of accept and submit to it, which a lot of people get very nervous and then it all falls apart.
But now, how much of a change did it feel like for the two of you in making Uncut Gems that you're working with someone like Kevin or say Julia Fox, where this is her first movie, but at the same time, you've got Adam Sandler, Idina Menzel, Eric Bogosian, Judd Hirsch. You have a level of actor that the two of you haven't really worked with before.
Yeah,
and what was that like?
That was also a function of Good Time, was working with veteran talent and seeing what that alchemy is when you put Jennifer Jason Leigh opposite a real-time bail bondsman, or Barkhad Abdi and Buddy Duress, or Rob Pattinson and Talia Webster. That was a big part of seeing how we can mix veteran experience with more virgin experience. That was fascinating and easy, relatively very easy, because you just end up spending more time on character development. And so the people who are necessarily really, you're trying to get them out of public perception, you're really just working, you're going above and beyond with biographies and spending time with real people and emulating those.
Yeah,
people.
And also when we were meeting with everybody, talking to them, we were like, okay, this is how we want to approach this. You know, we want it to come from you. We're not going to block things out perfectly. We want you to have the freedom. We're going to shoot our rehearsals. So we kind of give them these ways that we're working, and it's like, are you game for this? And everybody was really excited about it. The idea is, once everybody was there, it was strange. I'm holding the boom. I'm running the boom. I do the on that on set. So it's a strange thing to walk in and see.
I think that people in general feel a strong sense of agency with the roles that they're playing. And I don't think that we speak or direct different performers based on their past. I don't think it changes at all. I think you speak to people the way you speak to people. What changes is the way it does in real life. The way you talk to your mother is going to be very different than the way you talk to your friend. So, you know, that comes into play. You know, knowing insecurities that someone has, knowing what makes them tick, because a big part of it is just the transfer of enthusiasm and getting into something, finding what that thing is that they can relate to in every scene, and trying to will that from yourself onto them and then onto the screen.
We were joking with Adam, because like Keith Richards in the film,
Keith William Richards,
KW Richards. It was the first time he'd ever acted. Never even thought of it.
This is the guy who plays Phil,
and he's incredible. He has this way of speaking that we wanted to embrace, the words he chose. But when he got opposite Adam for the first time, we're like, I wonder what it's going to be like for him to be opposite Sandler. And then Sandler joking, like, that dropped out really fast. Like, he was for like maybe a second and then it just disappeared, and everybody was working. I guess that's a testament to all of everybody else, because Sandler was very open to that experience of working with somebody who was new and also never been in a movie. And it just, the idea, the openness and kind of communication that was all there, everybody was working together. And
I mean, a lot of it stems from production design, costume design. I mean, it's the entire crew coming together and building, and then the way we design, we have a very specific shot list design and storyboarding, what have you, but the way we go about capturing them is giving a lot of freedom to the actors, and we kind of adapt and try to find those shots within that. But I think that when they walk onto set, whether it's a real location in New York or it's on our actual stage for a lot of the stuff in the jewelry showroom, the amount of detail that's going into the set design and the costume design and things like that, and just the way we're having a lot of people on set who aren't even in the movie, who are just there for the vibe, which was helpful, you know. So you start to have these things. So then when they're walking off set, it doesn't feel like they're walking off set. It just kind of feels like the whole entire soundstage was the movie. You know, it didn't matter you were in someone's dressing room or you're outside, you know, because it was strange like that. Like the guy who played Roman, who's like the jeweler setter for Howard in the movie, he's a real jeweler in the Diamond District and our main scenic They're from the same town in Russia, this tiny little town in Russia. So I see them smoking a cigarette out on the stage afterwards, and they're both wearing these weird masks, like speaking, singing some old song that they knew together in Russian. And you just kind of see that, and you're like, all right, we're doing something right, because that's really what you're trying to get at. You're trying to create something and then just try to capture it.
With Adam Sandler, on the one hand, seeing the performance, it both completely connects to his work and kind of his persona, but it also feels really distinct and something fresh for him. What did you guys initially see in him? What for you was the inspiration to see Adam as Howard?
First of all, he's a very lovable person, and Howard was always somebody who you knew immediately, and that speaks to celebrity in some regards, but there was a patriarchal quality too, and Sandler kind of in a weird way feels like a father figure to us, just because at such a young age, those records that he did were so important to us. All those movies, obviously. I remember when Punch Drunk Love came out, it was a weird kind of green light that I saw in life. It was like, oh, wow, this thing that I loved so much as a kid is now meshing with my newfound interest. But I think Sandler in general did embody this kind of always on Rodney Dangerfield school of you know, a 20th century Jew kind of who can kind of command a room. And the stand-up comedy element of it was played in a big part.
And Howard was somebody we always knew you had to root for. You know, there were things that he was going to do that were going to question whether or not you liked him, but you always had to love him. And we love Sandler. And there's parts of his personality and the way that he acts. He can ground the most absurd situations just by making you feel like they're happening to him and you want him to get out of it.
Yeah, the absurdism is huge.
It's interesting. I saw him do a Q&A with you guys, and there's something modest and almost dismissive about him towards his own work. And yet he obviously, in this role in particular, is so specific, is so detailed.
He cares, and he put in so much time and effort. Like, we did a lot of prep work on this character. There were times where we were in a room and he was just literally watching a basketball game with rappers, degenerate gamblers, and just there was a whole
couple of bookies.
There was a whole room of bookies, and we just filmed it for 4 hours. And we're like, the only thing is, you need to be on. You need to be Howard, and it was just testing out the character.
In costume, early costume ideas.
And so these were moments where he was really trying to understand who it was, bringing bits of his father into the role, understanding who, like, oh, there's a little bit of Goldstein, but there's also a little bit of Dangerfield. Putting this all together and seeing him create it and build
and going,
it off of
himself. And
trailing jewelers
and watching him not only clock, you know, micro nuanced personality traits in these people, but not only watching him clock it, but see him turn and tell us mentally, take a note of that. We got to put that in the movie.
That's how.
And then if we don't do it, if it slips through the cracks, he brings it up.
He remembers
it. He'll bring it up into a scene later on. It's funny to see how similar the script is to what's on the screen, because he can memorize material because he can associate it with a deep place inside of him so that he can access it again. But he can go out on a limb and improvise a piece of a joke or what have you, and then come back. And sometimes he was improvising pieces from drafts 6 months prior to the shoot date. So we really did benefit from incredible work ethic, an insanely humble guy, as you're mentioning, modest person who doesn't care about all the hoopla and all that stuff. All he cares about is getting at something that A, interests him, B, he finds to be deep on some level, thought-provoking, and working. That's what he's interested in.
The thing was amazing.
Making people laugh.
When his wife saw the movie for the final one for the first time, she was so amazed that she was seeing Howard. She's like, I didn't see you on the screen. It was Howard. And that was so awesome because he really just disappears into the part. He doesn't want that credit in a lot of ways because he feels, A, it's on the screen, but it's also just, he's so humble. And I guess, people want to root for him because he just wants everybody to be having a good time, you know?
And now when I asked you earlier to sort of describe the movie, I think part of the reason why it's so hard to describe is the movie itself has this energy that I just don't know a lot of movies that have that feeling. It's aggressive. It's kind of disorienting.
The description should just be like a tone that you play.
I think the cool part about what makes the movie so like unique, I guess, and it just feels like something we did, but I'm starting to understand it from an outsider point of view a little bit now. I think what it is it's the combination of strange humor that's pervasive throughout the movie and where it's actually funny, but then there's also this level of of feeling like you're parlaying all of your own interests in, to get to one big thing that you don't even know what it is. So that adds to a level of kind of quote unquote anxiety. So you're having this humor at one point, which is a release, but then this tension at the same exact time. And you're seeing a character who is on all the time. So it's, and then you're seeing him off at times. So it is kind of strange, but I do think, you know, I mentioned to you before we started recording about the New York Film Festival premiere. You know, what was amazing to see the movie with 1,200 people in one room. I watched the last 40 minutes was to see the collective energy kind of drift towards the same vibe. And you're having all these people sitting on the edge of their seats laughing and then weirdly cheering. So it was, it's cool. It makes me feel, like we got at what we were trying to get at.
And so for the two of you, does Uncut Gems feel like, is this closing a chapter for you as filmmakers?
100%. It completely is. It was this thing that we constantly can return to. All right, we did that. Let's go back to Gems. And now it's like, okay, Gems is done now. You know, I mean, we have obviously again, like we have these other places to deposit ideas, but it's in a weird way, it's not the same because we've never stuck by something as long as this.
The thing that I like look at is that there are certain things that we saw were possible. Now these things and these techniques or things that you can have access to, you can now do on something else.
Josh, Benny Safdie, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
That's it for this week's show. Thanks to our producer, Paige Heimson. And thanks to our audio engineer, Eric Montgomery. Subscribe to The Real on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star review. You can also visit us at latimes.com/The Real.